So welcome to our presentation with Dr. Tracy Trancatella. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. She is involved with the BioHealth Lab, and she does a lot of work with BioHealth Lab, which I really love some of the work that she's done before for us in our nutritional endocrinology teaching panel. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She's a doctor of naturopathic medicine. She specializes in women's health, bioidentical hormone replacement, and thyroid and adrenal issues. And in addition, she works as a lab consultant for BioHealth Laboratory. And BioHealth is the lab that I use pretty exclusively for adrenal testing. And I would love to learn more about the brand new test that you just came out with, which is...
So I'm just going to let you know you're kind of going in and out a little bit.
I am? Okay, I'll get closer to my mic.
Yeah, okay. On my end. Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Yeah, so I would love to hear that. So I'd love to hear, you know, just tell people a little bit about you and, you know, what kind of work you do with the, with labs and how some of these tests can help them in really getting to the heart of what's going on with people.
Great. Okay. So, as Rita Marie said, I'm Dr. Tracy Trancatella. I'm a naturopathic physician, and I've been in practice for about 18 years, and I've used BioHealth Labs since I've been in practice, way back when Bill Timmons was around, and we learned a lot from him, and he really introduced us all to a new way of looking at functional medicine and assessing patients. And so, you know, I have always found that BioHealth has been very accurate in their testing, and I've stuck with them over the years. And, you know, I've ventured out and tried some other things here and there, but I always came back to BioHealth. And I started doing clinical advising for them about 6 years ago. And so I work a couple mornings a week talking to other doctors and practitioners, helping them to interpret their lab tests and talk about history of the patient and brainstorm some ideas of what we might be able to do to help that patient. And as of the past couple of months or so, BioHealth has really been working on revising their testing and their language around the adrenal stress profile in particular. And a lot of this is based on some of the work by Dr. Thomas Gilliams. He is a PhD. And he wrote a book called The Role of Stress and the HPA Axis in Chronic Disease Management. And this has been really some updated research that really hasn't been looked at for probably the past 10 years or so. And so he has really delved into that, and he has really brought us up to date in how to really evaluate the adrenals and really given us a new language around it to make it more comprehensive and more inclusive of what we're really looking at. Because this, when we're really looking at the adrenal glands, we're really evaluating the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And we've For the sake of simplicity, we've really tried to just call it adrenal fatigue, but really we're evaluating that whole system. It's just that we can measure cortisol very easily, and that's an endpoint hormone in response to the stimulation within that system. And so BioHealth has really revised their testing to try to encompass that concept. And in they're going to keep their adrenal stress profile around, so people can still order that if they want to. But they also have other testing, which is very similar, and it is just called an HPA stress profile. So what we're really looking at is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and we really want to change the language around adrenal testing so that people have a broader vision of what we're really looking at. There's been a real shift in the paradigm because of Dr. Gilliam's book, and BioHealth has really tried to include a lot of his ideas in revising their testing. And some of the details are that when we evaluate the adrenals, we know that there is a diurnal rhythm. We know that cortisol is highest in the morning and it tapers as the day goes on. So what we want to do specifically with the HPA axis profile is to make sure that people catch that morning sample at the right time. So we're advising patients to collect their sample within 30 minutes of waking up, because that is the time when cortisol peak in the morning. And what really causes that peak is before we wake up, we start to get an activation of the adrenals through the pituitary secreting ACTH to stimulate the release of cortisol. And within 30 minutes after waking, due to exposure of light, we activate the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, and that further drives the cortisol up, which peaks within 30 minutes of waking up. So in the past, the testing has given us the guideline of collecting a salivary sample between 6 and 8 a.m. And for some people, they may wake up naturally at 9 o'clock, and that's just what their rhythm between those 2 hours may not be their natural rhythm. So we may get a lower level of cortisol by not having them just collect their sample within or at the 30-minute mark after they wake up. So this is one of the new features, and it's very important because we want to catch the cortisol when it is supposed to peak in the morning, because ultimately that is going to contribute to the total cortisol. And if we have people collect the samples too early or too late, that morning cortisol may appear too low and lower the overall total of cortisol. And then we may incorrectly evaluate them as having more advanced fatigue than they really do. So this is an important aspect. The other important aspect is the they have changed when they do the DHEAS collection. In the past, on the adrenal stress profile, it was an average sample, and the unit of measurement was in nanograms per milliliter rather than nanomoles per milliliter. And all of the cortisol values are in the nanomole form, and so they have changed it so that the DHEA is measured in a molar equivalent to the cortisol. So you're comparing apples to apples, essentially. And they're also not doing an average sample. What they're doing is taking that DHEA measurement from the morning cortisol sample, because that is also when DHEA is highest. So those are two of the factors in terms of how we're measuring things. The other is that the reference ranges for DHEA are going to be specific for gender and age. So when people get their test results back, particularly practitioners who are looking at test results for a lot of people, they'll see a variation in the reference range for DHEAS because of the gender or age of their patient. So we're getting definitely more specific in how we're evaluating the adrenals so that we get better test results that are more accurate to the patient.
Wow. So, question about that is, if somebody's had the other adrenal stress profile done and then we're reevaluating them, is it going to be confusing to run this one, or should we really be running the other one to compare, or should we just jump right in and then see, you know, as a new starting time?
I think if you're doing a follow-up test, it would probably be better to use the older test. So again, it's using the whole apples to apples comparison.
Right.
Otherwise, you're starting with a slightly altered bit of material. And if you want to really compare how they're progressing to what they did before, I think it's better that you use the older test. But if you have new patients that you haven't run these tests on, my advice would be to start with the HPA stress profile. And they're all very similar to what the other adrenal stress profiles had. You know, you can do a 201, which was basically just the 4 cortisol and a DHEA measurement, or you could do a 205, which added on the sex hormones of estriol, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and melatonin. It's just that the HPA stress profile will fall within the parameters that I just described. And you'll also get, which is another unique feature, of the HPA stress profile is something that we feel is really important, which is a questionnaire. It's a 10-question questionnaire called the Perceived Stress Scale to allow people to evaluate and quantify their level of stress. And we feel this is a very important aspect to adrenal testing because so much of the stress comes from the mental emotional aspect. And it's important to know how much of a role that plays in a person's HPA axis dysfunction. And so this 10-question questionnaire quantifies each question, and then there is a score that correlates with the stress level. And that number is included on the test result. So it allows the practitioner to correlate what they're seeing with the test numbers with what they're seeing with the perceived stress scale as well. So it's also great for the patient to have some idea of how their level of stress is affecting their overall health.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let me ask you this. Have you looked at, like, on the same person, the two of the tests side by side to kind of get an idea of what the differences are?
Are you talking about an adrenal stress profile and an HPA stress profile?
Yeah.
Same person?
Yeah, at the same time.
I'm sorry,
at the same time. I'd be curious. I'm just, like the scientist Mindy says, okay, I wonder how they compare. So that if you guys had done a couple of those, that if we did want to just jump the gun and go to the new one on a person we'd already done one for, we'd get a general idea of how we could tell,
what the differences are. Well, I think you just have to look at it this way. If you were to run both tests on the same patient on the same day, you're going to see the results as being very similar, except for perhaps the DHEA, because on the adrenal stress profile, it's going to be an average sample, okay? So they're going to take the average of two measured samples. On the HPA profile, it's going to only come from that morning sample. So you may see a variation there.
Okay. So I have a question about DHEA ranges, and I know this comes up a lot when we do case study calls. Is the lab, the report actually says the normal range for DHEA is between 2 and 10. And I've always looked at it like, wow, 2 is really, really low, and there's a lot of people who are really, really depleted. Mm-hmm. I like to see it somewhere like 6 to 8. Can you give me your opinion on that? I don't remember where I learned that, but early on in learning how to read these, that's what I was taught.
Well, yeah, I think, when you're in the upper third of the range, that's always a good place to be. Okay. Whether it's for a male or a female, I think that's definitely a good place to be. But, if you run enough of these adrenal stress profiles or HPA profiles, you will find that many people are low. And they seem to be lower in the older population. Once you get into your 40s, you'll see that DHEA level will tend to drop off. I tend to see better and more robust DHEA levels in people who are in their late teens or in their 20s, because they're at peak production. So they're naturally going to be kicking out more DHEA than those of us who are older, in your 40s and 50s, because it's starting to drop off at that point, which is why the new stress profile, the HPA stress profile, is adjusted for gender and age, because we want to look and say, okay, what's normal for a person this age?
Mm-hmm. And is the normal like kind of like the lab normals, where it's the average in the population, or is it more like what we're striving for optimal health?
It is more of what is normal for the population, but I think what you're going to see is that it's also reflective of what is supposed to be healthy. And also you have to look at it in comparison to the person's cortisol level. As we always do, the ratio, I think, is very important to look at the DHEA in comparison to the cortisol. And as most of your listeners probably know, is that, this is why it's so important to put them in a ratio form, to look at cortisol compared to DHEA. and to have that ratio present and to have that optimized, because if we exist with too much cortisol as compared to DHEA, you're in more of a catabolic state. You're breaking down tissue to be mobilized for energy, and that's not a good place to be. And the body doesn't like that for very long. And so DHEA has the opposing effect of building up tissue. So, you know, I think the optimal point, things are getting much more refined, because you have to look at the age of the patient, the cortisol level, and where they stand in terms of their sources of stress, and aim to try to optimize that ratio so that they're more balanced, they're not breaking down tissue. You know, so that's, that I think we've always known in terms of, you know, assessing adrenal health, is making sure that the cortisol and DHEA are in a good ratio.
Right. Right. I see some of them that are through the roof.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's always very important. And, you know, this, the whole idea of evaluating, a person's perception of stress, you know, in the past and even now, we really evaluate adrenal fatigue. Many of us will look at it as stages, stage one, two, and three. Right. And it's not that we're abandoning that whole idea of there being stages. It helps us to kind of classify things as either, you know, being really bad, being worse, and being really in the tank. You know, it helps us to kind of put things in categories and assess where somebody is. But we can build on that and expand on that by looking at different patterns of HPA axis dysfunction and understand the history of the patient. It's so important for practitioners to take a good history from their patient and get a really good upfront evaluation so you know where these sources of stress are coming from, which is also why we've included the questionnaire to help practitioners really assess what portion of this person's stress is, you know, coming from their perception of stress. And then, you know, let's say, for example, you know, they have a very low level of perceived stress, but they also have a very under-functioning HPA axis. Then you have to start looking at other areas that are affecting their level of stress. You know, do they have blood sugar dysregulation? Do they not sleep well? Do they have sources of inflammation? Are they overweight? What are the other factors that are influencing the dysfunction? With, we always have to continue expanding our view and not try to always fit patients into a box, because they never fit in there very well. Mm. And really gather as much information as we can about the patient and sort of put that together in a very comprehensive approach in terms of how we're going to treat them.
Yeah. That makes total sense. So let me ask you another question, because this comes up a lot too. Well, people will say to me, well, when would I run a 201 versus a 204? When would I want to know all the other stuff about estrogen, progesterone, testosterone? Because in reality, if the adrenals are zonked out, those probably are going to be somewhat low just because of the precursors. Mm-hmm. Right. So when would it be a good idea?
Yeah. Right. I think, you know, my preferred first test is always going to be a 205. And with the new profiles, it's going to be the HPA stress profile, the number 205. And what you can do is you can add on to that, a cortisol awakening response, which I will talk about in a minute. And you can add on to that a secretory IgA, because that gives you a really good idea of what effect the HPA axis is having on immune function.
Right.
So there's a number of different panels, and I really encourage your listeners to go and look at the new BioHealth Laboratory website, because they have revised the website, and there's a lot of articles on there and a lot of educational materials that people can read. You know, these documents are like 1, 2, 3 pages. So a lot of good information there. But to answer your question, I think it's always best to start out with more information, because chances are, if you don't do enough, And you're looking at your test result and you're going, I wonder why, you know, their DHEA is so low and is it having an effect on their sex hormones? You know, that's always a question that I want to have. And if they have a high nighttime cortisol, I'm going to wonder if they also have a low nighttime melatonin. So for me, getting more information up front is always better. So starting out with a 205, I think, is a better way to go. In doing follow-up testing, you know, you can certainly do a 201 if you don't feel that you need to assess the sex hormones as often or regularly. If they were fine before and you don't need to look at them again and you want to do follow-up on looking at the HPA axis, then that's where I think the 201 comes in. Its best use is really more of a follow-up test than an initial screening.
Okay. That's good to know. That's definitely good to know. And then I'd love to address, with you some of the newer tests that are coming out. There's the dried urine tests that test for metabolites. Are the metabolites and then the difference between urine and saliva? I would love to hear your opinions on that.
I don't use a lot of the urine tests, but there is a lot of, there is good information on the BioHealth Laboratory website. And so they can speak to that better than I can at this point. You know, I know there's a lot of, testing out there that where they're doing the dried urine. And, I'm not a lab specialist. I know what I'm familiar with and I know what I like to use. So I can't really speak on that, at this point.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
So, one thing I would like to add though is I had mentioned, the cortisol awakening response as a part of the testing that BioHealth is doing. And this is a new concept that was, by Thomas Gilliam. In really assessing the HPA axis and the health of the HPA axis and its ability to respond to stressors. And what this is it's a component that can be added on to any one of the HPA stress profiles. And so it adds in two additional salivary samples, because what you're looking at are three salivary samples that are collected within the first hour of waking. As I was saying earlier, we've revised the testing to make sure that that morning sample is collected within 30 minutes of waking.
Right.
If the cortisol awakening response, we have a patient collect a sample within the first 5 minutes of waking, so we see what their waking sample is. Then we have them do their sample at 30 minutes, which would be the first sample in the HPA profile. And then we have them do their third sample at the 60-minute mark. And what you should see is that the cortisol from the waking sample should rise 35 to 60% above that waking sample. And that should be the peak point of cortisol production for the morning. And then by the 60-minute mark, it should drop off by about 50% and be near morning, near waking levels. And so what this tells us is the health of the HPA axis and how well it can respond to stress. Because waking up in the morning, as Thomas Gilliam phrases it, he says it's kind of like a mini stress test for the HPA axis. So if you crunch it down to an hour where you're really measuring that cortisol awakening response, it gives you a really good idea of what's going on with somebody and how that response will further influence other cortisol measurements throughout the day that you might be taking if you're doing a regular HPA stress profile. Because you know how we would look at different stages of adrenal fatigue and say, well, they're in stage one and stage two and stage three. But what we do know is that if we look at the cortisol awakening response and we see that somebody is elevated, maybe they have a lot of job stress. And so they wake up in the morning, you know, with the pedal to the metal and they're really ready to go. But what we do know is that the body does not want an elevated amount of cortisol around for a long time. So that system will down-regulate. So it won't provide any stimulus for the adrenals to keep kicking in cortisol. So that might be reflected later in the day as low cortisol because the system is compensating. You know, we know this system is based on feedback loops. So you get a stimulus to the adrenals puts out cortisol. The presence of the cortisol, if it's adequate, will downregulate the stimulus. And, you know, so that's a very important aspect of how this whole system works and why we're trying to expand the language around it so that people know we're not just looking at the adrenals. This is just the endpoint. We're looking at the whole system that may have an effect on the adrenals themselves.
Great answer. Thank you. And let me see if there's any questions that are coming in and anything else you want to maybe add to help people with clarifying this. That was very good clarification.
Well, let's see. I think... You know, in terms of treatment for what we're finding on some of the new testing, it's important to understand where those sources of stress are coming from. And in looking at the cortisol awakening response, which can be included in any of the HPA stress profiles, it gives us a broader view of what's really going on with the patient. And I think this is very important because, you know, all of us will have patients sometimes that we look at and we're surprised that they have such low cortisol output because they're usually really like high energy and they just kind of go. So this would be a typical example of somebody who might have an elevated cortisol awakening response but have low cortisol output for the rest of the day. And, you know, they're usually people who have a lot of job stress. Some people who have depression can have an elevated cortisol awakening response. The cortisol awakening response can typically go up with age. Or it may be elevated in a woman who happens to take her samples when she's ovulating. Mm-hmm. So there are certain factors that can influence the cortisol awakening response. If you see a low or blunted cortisol awakening response, that's a really good indication that you have a patient who's really burnt out, that the stressors that they're experiencing, they're just in a state of dysfunction that, you know, they can't even mount a good response. They have no more metabolic reserve. And they really are in a stage of burnout. And these are your chronic fatigue patients, people who have seasonal affective disorder, who have probably chronic ongoing illnesses that, you know, they can never really resolve. People with PTSD, you might see a low cortisol awakening response. So this gives us good insight into what we're really seeing with patients. And it also gives us another bit of information that directs our treatment. You know, using adaptogenic herbs, I think, is so important in the treatment of HPA axis dysfunction because people get to the point of this level of fatigue when there's too much input into the system. And they have a high level of perceived stress. And what those adaptogenic herbs often do is to turn the volume down on that stress response so that they're not so, you know, overreactive to a stressor when it occurs. And, you know, so using adaptogenic herbs, still using pregnenolone and DHEA as a source of support, nutrients that are so important, a lot of B vitamins, there's so many great adrenal support supplements out there that incorporate nutrients and adaptogenic herbs, which are really useful. And if people have an elevated stress response using things like phosphatidylserine to help lower that cortisol, particularly at night so that they can have a good night's sleep. Sleep is so important to the recovery of the HPA axis because it's like the reset button. So if you have patients who have a lot of stress and have a lot of HPA axis dysfunction, if they're not sleeping well, that really should be the first thing that is addressed, is making sure that they get a good night's sleep. And, you know, that's because it's going to be very hard to recover them if you can't get them sleeping well. Also in including minerals, magnesium, zinc, multi-mineral complexes. So the therapies that we use aren't necessarily changing just because we're changing the language around the testing and trying to refine how we're looking at this so that we can be more specific about what's really going on with our patients.
Yeah. Now, this is very clear because I think that looking back, because you were given a 2-hour window from 6 to 8, it's really possible that some of the people, when we came back and said, you know, that they did it right when they first got up, which a lot of people do, or an hour after they got up. And either of those, they're looking at the lower response. So this is really good to know. Very good to know.
Yeah, I think it's very important because oftentimes people will tell you that, you know, they get tired in the afternoon, and when you ask them, well, when do you feel best? When's your best point in the day? A lot of people will say in the morning, but then when you look at their test results, if they have a low cortisol level, it may be due to, you know, when they collected it.
Exactly. So it is really good to do that. And is there a big fee to add on that cortisol response thing?
And no, I believe it's only $25 extra.
Oh my, that's great.
You're really only collecting 2 more samples because that middle sample in the cortisol awakening response would be the first sample.
Right.
In the PA stress profile.
Yeah, so it's 2 extras. And Eva asks, because BioHealth very generously donated us a free test to each person that came to Shine at 205. And Eva wants to know, what can she do to upgrade it to an HBA access test? Is there like an add-on?
Well, you may be able to call the lab, and I can ask this question. I can email the lab and see, but if she wants to do the cortisol awakening response, it's likely that she can just add it in and pay the $25.
Okay, but what we had is the 205, the regular 205, the original
205. Oh, you do?
Yeah.
So you have the adrenal stress profile.
Yeah, so she's wondering, because it was before you came to campus. This is back in October, so...
I think I would have to ask. I would have to ask, and I could get back to you on that, Rita, because I would have to ask them.
And then I would go
the
and
guys
announce
who
it to the group. Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. You know, if there's an extra fee or whatever that we can add on to it, I think a lot of people would rather get that done. You know.
Yeah, the more information, the better. If you're going to take the time to do the test, do the big one.
Do the big one. And is there, are there videos on the site that talk about interpretation of it once they get it back?
You know, they have some samples. They have some lab samples, but, I don't think there are any, videos. There's a lot of, documents and there are some sample tests that you can look at. And you know, at some point we're coming out with a guide that does a more extensive, discussion of the tests and how they're used and how they're interpreted. So, but the website itself will provide your attendees with a lot of good information.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I know there's a lot of good stuff. There's been a lot of good stuff on that site for a long time. All right. What else? There was a question about how would this be helpful with someone with mitochondrial dysfunction?
Well, you know, I think part of HPA axis dysfunction can rest within, you know, the mitochondria because it's the mitochondria that take in the cholesterol and convert it to pregnenolone so that it's available for the cells to use. So I think supporting and treating mitochondrial dysfunction is a very important aspect of treating anyone with fatigue, particularly with any kind of HPA axis dysfunction. So if you have that documented, you know, if you've got a good HPA stress profile and somebody's really low and they're really fatigued, and if they don't respond to just some basic support for the HPA axis, then you really do need to get them on some mitochondrial support because that's kind of like the gap stop. If that's not working, it's just not going to happen. You know, your precursors aren't available to for use if you have mitochondrial dysfunction.
Right, right.
So, you know, they kind of go side by side. I don't view them as separate things, but even though they are two separate things, both things have to be working well.
Right.
So you can't treat one without the other.
Absolutely. That's why our very first module after the introduction in our nutritional endocrinology training is all about mitochondria and the details and how you support that, you know, how the energy is actually made. Because if that's broken,
yeah,
ain't nothing going to happen.
No, it's the cell doesn't function, you know. Yeah. Things just don't happen. It's like the factory's been shut down.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And a lot of people have some genetic SNPs that predisposed towards having mitochondrial issues where they'd have to actually increase some nutrients. And a lot of people have the SNPs, but they also have had a lot of, damage from high oxidation. And there's just a lot of things that can damage the mitochondria. And the interesting thing is I think we'll get is there's so many vicious cycles in our body. I'm fascinated by vicious cycles. And, you know, so a low mitochondrial function can affect the adrenals and the pregnenolone, cholesterol to pregnenolone conversation or conversion. But also when the mitochondria, they produce the adrenals produce a lot of oxidation byproducts when they're stressed, and that can affect the mitochondria negatively. And the mitochondria impact via oxidation byproducts. So it's really hard to remove one or the other or say work on one first because they are so intertwined, I think.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are. And, you know, I've had the experience of, you know, treating somebody's HPA dysfunction, and what is a well-chosen protocol and should have worked for her, about 6 weeks, she's like, I'm really just not feeling any better. And so when I added in some mitochondrial support, that was the thing. It was sort of like, everything was jammed up because of the mitochondrial dysfunction. It's like her body wanted to work, but I had to introduce some mitochondrial support to open up that pathway. Mm. And when I did that, it's like everything got so much better in a short period of time.
What do you like to use for mitochondrial support?
I like to use, there's some products through, and I don't know if I can mention, can I name names? Can I name products?
Go for it, please.
Okay, so I use a company, Research Nutritionals. They have some great mitochondrial support products, really high quality. And they have something called NT Factor Energy, and they have an ATP support product. They have a really high quality CoQ10 in the ubiquinol form. That's a pretty high potency and a good price for it being such a high potency. They do have a combination of carnitine and ribose in a powdered form, which I like. They also have... They have some good mineral supplements, which are also very useful. So those are usually my go-to items right there.
Great. Great. That's great. So Research Nutritionals was the company?
Yep.
Perfect. Awesome. Awesome. Let me see if there's any other questions. Adrian wants to know, what labs do you find the most useful?
Through BioHealth, they're 205. And I think you get the most information by doing the 205 with the cortisol awakening response with the secretory IgA, because that gives you a lot of information about how the HPA axis is functioning, what they're doing throughout the day, how they're responding to stressors throughout the day, and how it's affecting their mucosal immunity. So that's a good test. I also like their stool pathogen screen. Their stool screen is great.
Mm-hmm.
Their GI screen. I have to get used to the new names too. So their GI screen has always been a big hit with me, because I think that BioHealth is really great at isolating parasites.
Yeah.
And that to me is like first and foremost, when you're looking for any kind of problems in the gut, you have to determine whether or not people have infections. And a lot of other labs will, they'll identify a parasite, or they'll say, that there were a parasite was seen, but taxonomy unavailable. And to me, that's like, well, if you found a parasite, you really should tell me what kind of parasite it is.
I know what to do. Oh man, I know. Yeah, what about that one? That.
So that always bothered me. But BioHealth has been really good at isolating parasites and infections.
Yeah.
And their new format for their GI screen is that they have 6 different bacteria that they're looking for, and they quantify that as either no growth or abundant growth. So you've got either no growth, +1, +2, +3, or +4. And these are all gram-negative bacteria, which we know can produce endotoxin and cause a low level of chronic inflammation. And, you know, when we look at the results of this test and we look at the amount of bacteria, we have to always put that back into the clinical picture of the patient and what's going on with them. Oftentimes you'll get a GI screen that comes back with just a +4 E. coli. And it's the type of E. coli that is considered to be part of normal flora. But if you have somebody sitting before you who's got a lot of GI issues and that's the only thing we found, it might be that they've got some dysbiosis going on. And so you address it from that standpoint. If you find infections, if you find parasites, or if you find a lot of other bacteria, at least you have a direction for treatment. You know what to do with this patient. If they've got a parasite, you can treat them specifically for the parasite. You can do botanicals. You can do antibiotics if it's a really serious infection. But at least you know where to go with it. So that's always been a go-to test for me. And I made a lot of progress with patients in finding infections in them when they weren't found before. The other one that is very useful, I mean, everybody is looking for SIBO these days. And BioHealth has incorporated a SIBO breath test, a lactulose test. And it's a 3-hour test where you drink a solution of lactulose and then you collect breath samples every 20 minutes for 3 hours. And in that test, you're measuring the output of hydrogen and methane gases. And both hydrogen and methane are really the digestive byproduct from bacteria. Human digestion does not produce a significant amount of hydrogen and methane. So we know if those values are elevated that you've got a bacterial overgrowth.
Cool. And is that, there's a restriction. There's a restriction with most of the labs that you have to be an MD to be able to order that test because there's something about the lactulose. It's not supposed to be available.
Well, if you have a lactose intolerance, then you can't do this test. Yeah, so you shouldn't do this test. So if anybody is lactose intolerant, you really shouldn't be doing that test. But, you know, with the lactulose, most people will tolerate it pretty well. And we're seeing a lot of interesting results come back, and that really seem to support what people are seeing clinically in their practice with these patients. So it's an interesting test to run, and it also helps people to at least give a name to some of their chronic ongoing digestive disorders. And treating SIBO can be very tricky. It does have a high recurrence rate, but as far as treating SIBO, I think it's really important to address why somebody got SIBO.
Sure, right, absolutely.
You can't just give them a bunch of antimicrobials and expect it to not come back.
Exactly.
You know, clearly they've got some digestive problems. They don't digest things well. Maybe they have a low motility. There's a lot of things that can contribute to that bacterial overgrowth. And, you know, so that also comes with taking a really good history from your patient and understanding that and addressing those underlying causes as well as addressing the bacterial overgrowth.
Okay. So the thing about the lactulose, and it says here on your kit, it says that if you're authorized to prescribe the lactulose, you will need to supply your NPI number in the field below. All other clinicians may order under the physician authorization program, and I'm not sure what all that means, if we can actually order it or not, if we're not a
That is kind of a lab detail. So me being a naturopath, I haven't encountered that because I have an MPI number. So
yeah, exactly.
I think that's something that you would have to clarify with the lab itself.
Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. I think that was it for my, any other labs outside of the biohealth labs, like what would you be your typical first screening process with somebody? If you're seeing somebody for the first time and they're fatigued and they've, you know, they're you know, the usual maybe complaints, what would you do? Digestive stuff.
Usual complaints. So how to assess them.
Yeah.
What are okay. So yeah, first off, I'm going to do, as I said, like the 205, with the cortisol awakening response. Now this is a new thing, and looking at a SIGA, I think that's a great way to start. If they've got digestive problems and I have to be limited on the number of tests I'm going to do, I'm going to do a GI screen because I can get a lot of information from that. You know, so I don't like to overload patients initially with a lot of testing. You know, so I think for me, that's a good way to go. If I'm assessing fatigue, doing some basic blood work, is also very helpful. You know, we can't overlook some of the common things, like, you know, if they've got a thyroid disorder, or if they've got, some sort of anemia, or if they've got, an issue with different, variations in how they can detoxify. So, all of those things, like you had a previous gentleman on who was talking about genetic testing and SNPs and all of that. And that gets really specific, and I think it's always good to go there. But initially, when I see somebody, it may be basic blood work, a 205, and a GI screen. And that helps to get the ball rolling for me.
Great. Good to know. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let me see if there's any other questions. Otherwise, Maria wants to know, what do you think of the 101? And doing the 205.
The 101, yeah, the 101 is a good test too. It's a metabolic assessment profile. And so it gives you a good assessment of digestion. You know, if somebody is digesting their proteins, as a marker for that, if they're not digesting proteins well, the indicum will be elevated. It also tells you about liver detoxification capacity. And also looking at antioxidant status. So this is a good screening tool to look at some real general underlying things. You know, digestion, antioxidant status, and are you detoxifying properly? Do you have any issues with that? And should we get you supported right away? So for me, that's a way of screening to say, do I need to get this person on some digestive enzymes? Do I need to get them on antioxidants, and do I need to get them on liver support to help get everything moving? Yeah. And what kind of further testing do I need to do? Oftentimes, if you have an elevated indican, it may be because somebody has an H. pylori infection. And, you know, so it points in that direction.
Mm. So would you do like a 205 and a 101, 101 together as a starting point?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, you definitely could. You definitely could.
Okay, cool. I don't see any others. Last chance for a question. Oh, Brian, I'm sorry, I missed it. Brian says, Tracy, what about products for hormone support?
What product? Sex hormone support. And are we talking about, we're talking about specifically some of the products that Biomatrix is going to offer. They have some new products coming online. They should be around in February. And these are going to be plant-based hormones. One is going to have some plant-based estriol and progesterone. And these are oil-based products that can be used topically. Some people take them orally because they are in food-grade oil. So we have some practitioners out there who find that patients do better with an oral product. And because it's a food-grade oil, they can choose to use it that way if they want to. And then they also have a product coming that is just a plant-based progesterone. And so these are great products. They're very pure. Being that they're in an oil, I think they're great for people who are sensitive to any kind of additive or things that you get through a compound. You apply topically, or they can be taken orally. So it's a nice option for a lot of practitioners out there to be able to add that to their treatment program.
Great. I'm glad to hear that, because they used to have a sublingual progesterone, and they took it off the market for a while, and it was, everybody loved it. Everybody that I was working with that just was so disappointed that they took it off. So it's really nice to know that they have estriol on that in the topical.
They've got their things coming back. It's great because a lot of people really, really miss that product. They liked it a lot. You know, and they'll go under the name of ProAdapt and ProAdapt E. And, so, you know, they'll be out in February or March and they have, the oils are very stable. They have a good shelf life and, you know, so people can use them and keep them around for a while. And, the nice thing about these is that you have some patients who can be very, very sensitive to things, you know, so with products like this, you can start in low dosages and work your way up. And so it's nice to be able to modify dosages and to be able to modify dosages maybe throughout a woman's cycle. Yeah. You know, maybe she needs less of a hormone in the beginning and more of it later in the cycle.
Right. Right. That's why I loved them. And then that's why I use, whenever I'm going to do any kind of DHEA or pregnenolone supplementation, I always use the sublinguals, the Biomatrix sublinguals, just because of that exact reason. I had one person who one drop of DHEA was all she could take because she ended up with acne or whiskers or whatever, but it worked. Like 4 months later, her DHEA levels had risen on her test. So, and some people are taking three drops three times a day. So, or more sometimes, but usually more than three drops three times a day, but it works really well. And I think that absorption is really high. Are they going to be as well absorbed as the sublinguals in the oil form?
I definitely think so. I mean, hormones are lipophilic, so being in an oil base is kind of a good match in terms of absorption. So, yeah, and the oils are stable, so, you know, and I think they're gonna taste okay if somebody chooses to do them orally. I think it's great that they're bringing back the progesterone and they're also adding another product that's got a little bit of plant-based estriol in it.
Great. Super duper. Great.
Yeah.
I don't have any other questions. Let's see if anybody else does. I don't see any others. Let me scroll backwards to see if there's anything I missed. Otherwise, we will call it a night. That's it. Thank you so very much for this. This was great. Lots of great information and appreciate your time and attention.
Okay. All right. Everybody have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you everybody for being here.